Good morning and welcome to Neocone View. I'm Peter Newman with you on this Monday morning. And with us this morning is a resident of Neocone, as it happens, North Tillamook County, architect and, should I say, community activist and man of letters, Tom Bender. Good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
How do you feel about the term? Am I a community activist? How do you feel about that?
I've been called a lot of things.
So this one doesn't bother you, or no. Does it encourage you?
I do what I do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about activism in a way, because mm-hmm. what you do, in addition to your architectural work, is you are an active person. And you are in the community, so I guess one way or the other those terms fit. And, you know, as I we are broadcasting this morning from your home, or one of the kind of working area on your property, and your architectural work is so extraordinary, and we can talk about the specific buildings to give an illustration, but is there an overall philosophy of how you look at the work you do, and where did that come from?
It comes from wanting to be invisible. When I got my architecture degree, I looked at what I could do, and it stunk. And I looked at what everybody else was doing, and it stunk. It all felt sterile and empty. And so I said, well, we've got to do something different. And so I've spent the last 30, 40 years trying to put soul back into the way we do things. And no sense of how to do it other than just fumbling around and by feel. And this feels good, that feels bad. First time I actually, when we built our own house, I'm trying to put two boards together, and should it go like this or should it go like this? Should the trim on the windows go like this or like that? And I learned quickly there's three answers. Yuck, rip it off. Duh, I don't know. And hey, yeah. So retrospect is a good way of figuring out, try something. If you don't try anything, you'll never get anywhere. You try something and see how it feels.
Well, I was struck, I think, the first time I walked into your living room, I was struck by how I wasn't quite sure where the interior ended and the exterior began as a space. And I think, in a lot of respects, that sort of defines a lot of your work. Take, for example, here in North County, probably one of the best-known examples, the Bank of Astoria, which really sits on the land and sits in its place in a most wonderful way.
Thank you.
Yeah, and but so many things have to go into that. I mean, these are not accidents. Let's take Bank of Astoria. That was not done in retrospect. That was done for a bank that expected a project and expected something pretty well defined.
It comes from trying to recognize what needs to be dealt with and trying to figure out good ways to deal with it. In retrospect, the Bank of Astoria fits the Chinese feng shui philosophy beautifully. It has south-facing, it has a pond reflecting light and trees behind it and all this stuff. But that it wasn't at all the situation. The situation was you wanted it to be visible from the street. We were wanting to deal with rainwater off the roof and to honor the rain and the water, which is so important a part of our environment here. We needed protection because somebody coming in the south doors from the street when the wind is blowing 100 miles an hour and the rain is coming down, you got to have a little protection. So one thing led to another, and there's a glass canopy, there's a pond on a slope, which is kind of hard to do sometimes.
And there's that, as with your own place, the outside world coming in through that marvelous centerpiece in the bank.
And it's one thing that's important to me is honoring the spirit of the place and honoring nature and bringing it in. And as you say, getting rid of the disconnect between inside and outside. People talk about green architecture and natural lighting, for example. But that can be done in an engineering way, which brings in cold, sterile outside light of a certain quantity of light. Or like the Bank of Astoria, you go in there and there's ripples on the ceiling of sunlight reflecting off of the pond. So you can hear the water, you can feel the You can see the sunlight rippling on the ceiling, reflecting the sun and the wind outside. So it's getting all those things deeply and intimately connected is what, to me, gives power to a place.
At what point in your career did that really come together as something that you really knew you wanted to be a part of? Was it there from the very start? For that matter, was the notion of becoming an architect there at the start?
No, I was assuming I was going to be an engineer or physicist when I was in high school. I'd loved the sciences. For some odd reason, my senior year in high school, my dad subscribed to Architecture Forum, which he had no reason to do. I started looking at this stuff and said, ooh, I can do better than that. You know, a teenager. And I did 1 year of engineering, and I felt that the people that I was with were one-dimensional. Which, of course, was just a perception. There are some wonderfully multidimensional physicists. But I decided I wanted to try the architecture as an alternative, and it did seem to make use of more parts of me, and that was the direction I headed.
So random encounters and removing things and trying it out notwithstanding, was it there at the start where that you thought you had a vision of how you wanted things to look and feel?
No, it was just a sense that we need to do better, and I'm willing to try.
Another building that's in our area more recently is St. Catherine's. Mm-hmm. What was the process in designing that space?
There were a number of processes. I very consciously on that project was doing a co-design process with spirit guides of the church, the congregation, the community, the place. And I went into it with an intention of opening the sanctuary to the garden outside. It has a lovely site. First, when we really took a close look at the site, we found out that native plants have been very strongly minimized and all sorts of exotics brought in. The woman who lived there was part of the garden club, and wonderful exotic things from China and all over the world were brought in and planted there in a friend's place over in the Nehalem. And we discovered that at least seven or eight of the big old spruce trees were suddenly dying. But I still, every time I try to design the sanctuary and try to put a window in it, it's like something grabbed my hand and said, no. Now, wait a minute. Who's designing this? Oh, that's right. You're designing it. And what I came to understand eventually on it was that it's one thing at a time. The design on the church was not to make a church that was ego, was trying to be attract attention. It's screened from the street, so it's not trying to advertise. It's trying to be in seclusion and an opportunity and a place to go deep spiritually. The sense that the garden, the sacred garden, was as central as the sanctuary was a part of the design. You go into the entry into the narthex, which in churches are sort of the place you transition from normal space into sacred space. The narthex, in this case, goes entrance to both the sacred garden and to the sanctuary. But what the guidance I got on it was saying, one at a time. When you're in the sanctuary, focus solely on that. When you're in the garden, you're in the garden.
Before, we've been talking about individual structures and projects, but in a, how do I put it, a former life when you were in Portland, you were dealing with, let's say, more macro issues, both in publication and with the state of Oregon. What was that? That's exercising quite a different part of your brain, I would think.
Yeah, it turns out there's parts of our brain that are parts of our consciousness that we were never taught about in school. Back in Minnesota, when I was teaching architecture there, someone said that we needed to reduce our energy use by 80% for the rest of the world to be able to have equal opportunity.
What an enlightened concept.
But every time that was mentioned, there was silence, and then somebody changed the subject. And suddenly I picked up on that. I said, what's going on? And I realized that no one had a clue of what could be done. So they just put that question aside. So I got out the proverbial back of an envelope and say, well, buildings are a huge part of our energy use. What can we do? And I figured out ways to reduce energy use in our homes by 90%, which is pretty amazing. You know, 90%, that's 9/10 of it. And this was back in 1973, and we've got way, way better understanding of how to go about things now. But out of that, we built the Ouroboros Project, which was one of the first regionally self-reliant demonstration houses in Minnesota, very cold northern climate. Out of that, I also came to the point and published that we can have a better quality of life using less energy. And that got picked up by Tom McCall's office during the 74 oil crisis. And they asked me to come out and help develop energy policy for the 13 Western states. And out of that, we put together some of the most fundamental ways of transforming both our energy and resource depletion and turn it into positive directions to go.
This is Neocone View. I'm Peter Newman. My guest this morning is architect Tom Bender. And Tom, the example you just gave, starting in the early, mid-1970s, there was an energy crisis then. There seemed to have been an energy crisis when gas prices went up, and who knows what is happening with the oil situation in the Gulf, but we're in another period in which we're re-examining these things. Do we need these sort of shocks to our system to get us to think about that? And how long do these shocks last? It seems like there's a tendency to go back to our old ways once we put a Band-Aid on it.
Yep, we do. And we really, most of us don't change until we have to, until that's the simplest. It's much more painful to continue doing things that aren't appropriate anymore and take up new things which turn out to be exciting and feel way better.
And yet at this particular moment, I don't get the sense of urgency that accompanied the environmental movement and the push for more stringent fuel consumption standards on automobiles. We seem to be in a period in which things are at least in as crisis a point as it was then, but we seem a little bit less motivated to make changes. Is it because some changes have been done and we're just sort of resting?
I think it has to do with the media, the politics, the inertia. Everyone in those realms are tied together and beholden to financial interests, corporate interests that want to continue doing things the way they have been because they have been benefiting hugely financially from them and pulling money out of all of our pockets. How can a president be elected unless he has enough money to buy enough advertising to compete with other candidates? One of the things that seems really important to me now is getting back to free elections, of ensuring that any political candidate has free and equal access to the media. This is required in most other countries. The United States is one of the very few countries that is basically who can pay the most to use our public media gets elected. And those, the paybacks on that, once you are elected, you don't get reelected unless you pay back who financed your campaign. And so things aren't going to change. Things don't get even on the table, like single-payer health care. And the things which are real order of magnitude possibilities for change get totally ignored.
I said at the beginning, community activists, and you weren't sure about whether to accept that definition. I think I see some of that coming out. What about in our community? I mean, you mentioned sort of at the federal level, and a lot of these regulations just by almost by definition would take place at that level. But locally, how do you think Tillamook County and our listeners in Clatsop County, how are we doing on these issues?
Clatsop County has been doing some wonderful things. The no LNG has been successful with the Bradwood Landing. Hooray. One more to go. One down, one to go. for an absolutely insane you know, projects that benefit outside interests. Tillamook County, the Tillamook PUD board has committed to obtaining all of its future energy need through increased efficiency of use of its existing energy, reducing improving the efficiency of existing users to release energy, renewable energy we already have, so that others can use it. That's a long way from implementation, but that is one piece that is happening. When things made their first bump of crash a couple years ago, I looked around and said, okay, the economy's flat, all the builders are out of work, there's no need for architects. How do we deal with things? What I put together on that was a concept I called tilowatts rather than kilowatts, which is saying we can do deep energy retrofits on our existing homes and reduce the energy use in them by 80%. Not quite as much here because Oregon has done a lot on energy, but 60-70% for sure. If we put effort into deep energy retrofit of existing homes, suddenly we have employment for the building trades. It's local, the money stays in the community. And coupling this then with accessory dwelling unit ordinances, which allow people to split off a portion of their home for a separate, small, affordable housing. Half of our housing stock is three-bedroom ranches, and all you have to do is close off a three-foot hallway, and suddenly the back two bedrooms can be a separate apartment. So we have a lot of retirees who kids have grown up and they're rattling around in a three-bedroom house. Doing a deep energy retrofit means suddenly that two families can have housing on less energy than one family, and that suddenly you have affordable housing at pennies on the dollar. Our homes become storm safe. You can stay warm when the power is out. So it's one of those win-win-win-win-win situations. That's just one concept, but a lot is happening in this area. We have NIACASA, our Affordable Housing Community Land Trust, has put together a flexplex design for housing, which is a duplex which can change configuration over time. It can be a large multi-generational house. It can be an upstairs-downstairs duplex. You can come from the entry right into one or two of the bedrooms, which means it can be a home occupation. Or if the kids have grown up, you can rent out a bedroom to be a neighborhood guest room. Putting together, looking holistically at the economics of it, the construction cost on a house is less than a third of the overall cost. The energy operating costs, the financing costs are both larger. The homeowner is third in line after the bankers and the oil companies. And by reducing the energy and the financing costs or eliminating those over time, you're cutting costs down in a huge amount. But adding up the cost of a guest room, there's what it costs to build per square foot, there's a financing cost, there's the energy operating cost, and suddenly you're up to almost $100,000 of what just to have a guest room that sits empty most of the time. And if there's one in the neighborhood, share it.
Well, yeah, that's an issue which I think is terribly important in our area, is the question of affordable housing, because it really gets to the character of what our character as a community is. There are people who in past generations would have lived here and raised families who cannot afford to live and raise a family here. And that profoundly, I think, affects who and what we are as a community. I take it that housing plan would get right to the heart of that matter.
There's a lot of pieces of it. What the way we've dealt with so-called affordable housing in the past has been a charity thing. It's been tokenism, politics, the tax credit financing, people, you get the majority of the money, the nonprofits take all the risks, and 15 years later, the houses go back onto the open market, all the state money now is going to repurchase affordable housing units that are suddenly flipping and going back into the market. There's a lot of dimensions of it. One of the issues, basic issues, is we don't pay living wages. We don't require a minimum wage, which is a living wage, which is ridiculous. There are a lot of communities that do. It can be done on a community, a state level. It doesn't have to be a national thing. And so that would be one way to, people have enough income so they can afford housing. If they don't have enough income, or if there's things like we have the issues of competition for housing, for vacation homes and short-term rentals and things, then there's a lot of other pieces that need to be dealt with and putting together. So back in the 70s, we got things called energy-efficient mortgages developed, which acknowledged that people pay their electric bills or fuel bills out of the same pocket as a mortgage, and that if you build a house efficiently or energy efficient, that's money that's released from one to deal with the other. So we're putting together a whole package of strategies which look like they have the potential for reducing housing costs by 80%.
You spoke earlier about getting efficiencies and savings through energy conservation. Are there any alternative energy sources that you think are worth looking at, or does it all come down to there's a price hidden or otherwise to be paid for all of them?
The most efficient energy source is efficiency. And until we have really looked at that and dealt with it, we are wasting everybody's money looking for new ways to spend a lot more money for new energy sources. Our automobile fuel economy average is something like 22 miles a gallon. Europe is 43, Japan is 47, something like that. You can go out on the streets in Europe and buy a Volkswagen that gets 75 miles a gallon. This is ridiculous.
And, when you start thinking about solar power, well, that's free energy from the sun, except there's all the metals and technology that go into creating those solar panels. So it seems to me there is a price to be paid, and you can go down the list of any energy source and find an equivalent example or illustration of that.
Any energy source used to meet totally unrestrained demands for energy is going to be a failure. It's going to just consume everything. We here can be using 100% renewable energy right now. I mean, this is one of those accidents that 80% of the, at least Tillamook PUD energy is Bonneville hydroelectric power.
And of course, those dams would not have been built today if they haven't. Yes. Hydroelectric
right.
is
the salmon and a lot of other issues,
right?
But that is, and it's an 18th century, 19th century mechanistic way of dealing with things. A really innovative approach would not be using a lot of big physical turbines and things, or either windmills or water mills or whatever to produce energy. There's much more subtle ways of doing things. But the one example, Tillamook County has a methane digester, which takes cow and turns it into electricity. So for $4 a month, we replace our non-renewable energy from the PUD with power from the methane plant. So we're running 100% renewable.
How about in your own home? You must have some tricks of the trade that you've employed for your own environment.
Well, our house we built 33 years ago. And it was had some innovations at that point, but we can go way beyond that now. We, at that point, we were one of the very first houses to do 2x6 construction and to do passive solar and to do advanced framing, which puts studs at 24 on center, and there's less thermal transfer through the walls. But there, by going today to R60 roofs, R40 walls, and high efficiency windows, we can reduce our, and also tidying the house up, getting rid of unwanted leaks, we can reduce our energy use immensely. 25% of the energy used to heat a house is from leaks.
And you don't pay an aesthetic price for that either. I mean, they're certainly not in your home. I think your home is just a gem, as are the others that I've seen that you've had a hand in designing. I mean, this is not, you're not giving up anything. In fact, of course, you're saving money if you're reducing your energy cost.
Again, looking at things holistically, you can put solar panels on a house, but that's not integrated with it. Once you start putting things together, you're connecting with nature, you're being outside more, you're in a smaller house, you're doing things very differently, you're reducing your demands to much more reasonable things, and then you start integrating the things together. The environmental approach of saying that, you know, we have to have green energy, we have to have renewable energy, has been an excuse to foist, well, let's say, wind farms on the coast. Back in the 70s and 80s, the American Wind Association said the absolutely lowest priority is in scenic areas. And the Oregon coast is a world-class scenic and spiritual resource. And there was a attempt to put something like 70 or 80 wind generators on the mountains between Garibaldi and Wheeler a few years ago, which at night, their flashing red lights would have been lovely, if nothing else. A bunch of Texans who had no sense of which direction the wind came from, and it would have been a disaster.
Well, there's so much more we could talk about. I want to shout out to your website, because people who want to learn and read more of you, your website is?
TomBender.org.
And it's a terrific resource and a great read, if you can apply that name to a website.
It goes off in a lot of wild directions.
Yeah, it's terrific. Thank you, Tom Bender, for joining us this morning on the Econi View, and keep up the activity and the energy.
All righty. You too.